This message, titled, An Accusing Friend, from Job 15, verse 1 through Job 17, verse 16, was preached at Winchester Reformed Presbyterian Church in Winchester, Kansas. For more information, visit winchesterrp.com. Well, brothers and sisters, I wonder this morning if I were to say and to put together, string together a few words, what it is that would come to mind. What comes to mind this morning if I say the words war club, sword, and sharp arrow? What are the pictures that come to mind? What are the associations you make with those words? Or to ask this question, what might those words have in common? A war club, a sword, a sharp arrow. I assume this morning many of our minds probably go to the same place. Well, those are weapons. Those are things that are fashioned as instruments of war. Those are things that in the hand of unwieldy people could be very dangerous, unintentionally so, and in the hand of very wieldy people, very wise people, warriors and fighters, those are things that can be very deadly. They are things that were made to wound and to maim, to kill, to draw blood, and to hurt. But I wonder this morning, what else might come to your mind when you think of those words, war club, sword, and sharp arrow? Well, when the Bible uses that imagery, the Bible tells us that with each of those, the club, the sword, and the arrow, that each of those is like a person who bears false witness against their neighbor. One who bears false witness. One who speaks wrongly. One who makes false accusations about his neighbor is like a war club, is like a sword, is like a sharp arrow, where words have the power to break and to crush and to strike and to pierce and to stab and to wound, and to maim the heart of another. The Bible tells us, wisdom teaches us, that bearing false witness, making false accusations, is as deadly and dangerous as those weapons of war. And what I want to begin by asking you this morning is this: how do you respond when you're falsely accused? Many of us, all of us, at one time or another, I trust, have been in that position where somebody has borne false testimony, not simply against somebody else, but against me. How do you respond when somebody bears false witness? How do you respond when somebody accuses you falsely? It's an important question. Well, this morning, as we come to Job chapter 15, we come to what is often called the second cycle of speeches. You remember, as we've been working our way through Job, Job's three friends come to him in his suffering, and each of his friends have broken the silence. Each of them have taken the opportunity to talk to Job, to try to diagnose his problem and to prescribe a remedy for him. And in each of those cases, after the friends get done speaking, we have had a response from Job. And so it has gone back and forth, back and forth. And all three friends have spoken, and Job has responded, but that's not the end of the matter. And we come in the 15th chapter to the second cycle, where all three friends will again address Job, again break the silence, again try to prescribe and to describe what Job is going through. And Job, in turn, will respond to Eliphaz. He will respond to Bildad. He will respond to Zophar. And as we come to this second cycle of speeches, we begin to see that Job's three friends really begin to turn the heat up. They turn the heat up to such a degree that it seems that these friends of Job actually sound more like foes. They begin to sound more like foes as unrelentingly they come after Job, after his person and his character. And they begin to repeat themselves. It's one of the challenges of Job. Job is a very repetitive book. There's very little said in the main chapters that is new and novel, and they renew their attacks against their friends. Perhaps the best way to characterize this second cycle of speeches is to see from different angles what Job's friends really become. What I mean by that is Eliphaz really becomes the friend that accuses Job. Bildad, as we'll see in weeks to come, really becomes the friend that usurps the rights of God in Job's life. And Zophar becomes the friend that mocks Job in his suffering. These friends begin to sound more like foes. And this morning, what I want to do is look at this first friend, to look at Eliphaz and his response to Job in the midst of his suffering. If you remember from Job chapter 4, Eliphaz was in the first cycle the first to speak. And of all of his friends at that time, he was probably the softest. He came to Job, and he came somewhat tenderly and somewhat gently. But what we're going to see this morning is as he comes to his second speech to Job, he throws off all gentleness, he throws off all softness, and he becomes very harsh toward Job. And what he does is he brings to this man who is suffering a whole list of false accusations. And I want us to look and to consider this morning Eliphaz's accusations and then Job's answer. Accusations and answers. So first I want us to examine this morning Eliphaz's accusations. His accusation. I remember hearing once, and it's something that really stuck with me, that one of the best measurements of our godliness, one of the best external evidences of God's grace in our lives, is how you respond to somebody when they disagree with you. One of the greatest outward measurements of our godliness is how I respond to other people in the midst of disagreements. And I think this morning it would take very little to prove that that is especially true with those who are closest to us. How do we respond to our spouse when there's a disagreement? How do we respond to our children when there's a disagreement? How do we respond to our parents when we disagree with them? How do we respond to one another, brothers and sisters in Christ, when there is a disagreement? How do you, brothers and sisters, respond? Because in one sense, I think it is accurate to say it's one of the greatest outward measurements of our godliness. Well, obviously, as we come to chapter 15, there is a disagreement. Eliphaz, Bildad, Zophar have all brought these words before Job. All of them in one form or another, same argument given in a different way. Tell Job, hey, Job, you are suffering because you're sinful. They're saying there is unrepentant sin in your life, and that's why you're suffering. So Job, here's the remedy. You've got to repent. We don't know what the specific sin is. You've got to search it out. You've got to figure it out. And you have to come and repent if you want to overcome this suffering. And we saw with Eliphaz's first speech that he really was reasoning backwards, wasn't he? He was reasoning, well, what you reap, Job, is what you have sown. But we know from the scriptures that that is not always true. There is this disagreement, and Job says to his friends, not once, not twice, but three times, his answer can be summed up pretty simply, no. I'm not suffering because there's sin. I've searched my heart. I've prayed that God would show me sin in my life, and there is no answer. There is only silence. I am not suffering on account of my sin. But what we find in this 15th chapter is that Eliphaz simply couldn't take no for an answer. He couldn't take no for an answer. So how does he respond? Well, in these 35 verses of chapter 15, Eliphaz responds with a whole series of accusations. In verses 2 and 3, he accuses Job of being foolish. Should a wise man answer with windy knowledge and fill his belly with the east wind? Should he argue in unprofitable talk or in words with which he can do no good? Eliphaz is saying, Job, you're a fool. And your folly is evident to all. Eliphaz accuses Job of blasphemy. In verses 4 through 6, he says, Job, you're doing away with the fear of God. You're hindering, he says, meditation before God. In verse 5, he says, you choose the tongue of the crafty. That word there, crafty, is the same word that we find in Genesis chapter 3, verse 1. Now, the serpent was the most crafty of the animals. And Eliphaz is actually saying, you have chosen the tongue of Satan himself. You are speaking diabolical things, Job. He goes on to accuse Job of pride in chapters 7 through 10. Are you the first man who was born, Job? Or were you brought forth before the hills? Have you listened to the counsel of God? And do you limit yourself, wisdom to yourself? He's saying, Job, you're so arrogant. You open your mouth and your arrogance just comes out. He accuses Job of undervaluing counsel. In verse 11, are the comforts of God too small for you? Or the word that deals gently with you. He's saying, you just ignore everything we say. You don't find any value in the words that we speak to you. He accuses Job of being stubborn. In verses 12 and 13, why does your heart carry you away and why do you flash your eyes? He accuses Job of being unrighteous in verses 14 through 16. What is man that he can be pure, or he who is born of a woman that he can be righteous? Behold, God puts no trust in his holy ones, and the heavens are not pure in his sight. How much less one who is corrupt? A man who drinks injustice, and you need to read between the lines. Eliphaz is saying, Job, that's you. You're unrighteous. You see, Eliphaz comes with accusation after accusation. And then in verses 17 through 35, what he really does after he lays these accusations at Job's feet, he really doubles down. And he repeats himself. He sought to discredit Job, and then he reasserts himself. And those verses are filled with Eliphaz's observations of the world to try to show that it is only the ungodly who suffer. He doubles down on the argument that he has been making. You see, Eliphaz is really acting like a dog who's backed into a corner. Here, Job has reasoned with him. He can't take no for an answer, so he starts to bark and to bite a little harder. And he can see no way out. And so the easiest way to win the debate is to bring these false accusations against Job. But the question I have this morning is why? Why does Eliphaz respond that way? What are the motivations lying behind these accusations? Why does Eliphaz accuse Job of so much? Well, I think there's a number of reasons presented in this text to inform us on that. So let's look at a couple of them. In the first place, this accusation of Eliphaz, this accusation really comes because Eliphaz has misunderstood the situation. You remember how the book of Job begins. We need to always keep those first couple chapters in mind. Because the continual argument that Job's friends make, Job, you're suffering because you are unrighteous. But we know from the very beginning of the book, as the Holy Spirit gives us a glimpse into heaven itself, that it's anything but. Job is not suffering because he is unrighteous. The exact opposite is actually true. Job is suffering because he is righteous. Because Satan has thrown the gauntlet down. God has entered into a chat. Have you considered my servant Job? He is holy and he is blameless, and there is none like him in his generation. And Satan defying God, take everything away, and your righteous Job will curse you to your face. Job is not suffering because he is unrighteous. He is suffering because he is righteous. And Eliphaz doesn't understand it. Eliphaz misunderstands the whole thing. And of course, we might say, well, Eliphaz couldn't see what happened in heaven. Eliphaz isn't privy to the information you and I are privy to, this scene that we've been given of God and Satan. Eliphaz doesn't know that. He doesn't see what happened. And you see, brothers and sisters, that's exactly the point. That's exactly the point. Eliphaz is a man with limited knowledge. Eliphaz is a man with a very small perspective on a very big problem. Eliphaz is one who is operating on minimal facts. Eliphaz is one whose understanding is, to put it this way, paper thin. And yet here is a man who is so quick to pass judgment. Here is a man who is blind to his limited knowledge. Here is a man who is completely unaware of the fact that he has a limited perspective. Here is a man who is oblivious to the truth that he is operating on minimal facts. And yet here is a man who is so eager to judge the case of Job. And you know what, brothers and sisters? We see this all the time in the world around us. We see this all the time in the world around us. People misunderstanding and misjudging situations and circumstances based on limited knowledge, limited perspective, limited understanding, and yet they jump to snap judgments. But it's not just the world around us. People in the church do it. Christians do it. You and I do the exact same thing. I remember a number of years ago, somebody coming to me, somewhat out of the blue to me, and they said, "You know, Kyle, I've really got a bone to pick with you." I said, "Oh, well, what's that?" And they said, "Well, you did this and you did that." I said, "No, wait a minute. Where did you hear that?" "Well, so-and-so told me that's what happened." And I'm thankful that I was able in that case to say, "Well, that's not the case at all. You don't have the facts. You don't have the right perspective. You've been sold a bill of goods. You don't understand what's going on." And yet how quick they were to jump to conclusions, to jump to a judgment. And I do that. I do that. You do that. We all do that. We misunderstand a situation and a circumstance, and the easiest thing is to think, "I know it all. My perspective is all seen. And so because I know it all, I'm going to tell you how it is." And oftentimes the result of that is all kinds of false accusations. But brothers and sisters, common sense, and even much more sanctified common sense, reminds us and ought to teach us that we are to be men and women, young and old, people of understanding. People who try to understand the situation. People who try to understand the circumstance. People who try to understand the relationship. To acknowledge our limits. To listen carefully. To listen judiciously. To ask questions. To be guided by the rules of charity and love. So that we don't misunderstand things. But you see, Eliphaz has no understanding. That's one of the reasons he accuses and falsely accuses Job of so many things. But it's not just a misunderstanding. Eliphaz here, he also accuses Job because he overestimates himself. And we've seen that before with Job's three friends, but we see it come forth in a very particular way that is worth noting this morning. Look at verse 7. Look at verse 7 as Eliphaz is talking there in the 15th chapter. He asks Job a couple of questions. Are you the first man who was born? Or were you brought forth before the hills? Have you listened in the counsel of God? Silly questions to be asking because it's not true of Eliphaz either. But Eliphaz asks him these questions and then he says, and do you limit wisdom to yourself? And then in verse 9, what do you know that we do not know? What do you understand that is not clear to us? In verse 10, both the gray-haired and the aged are among us, older than your father. What is Eliphaz doing? Eliphaz is pulling rank. Eliphaz is saying, Job, I'm older than you. And because I'm older than you, you need to be quiet and you need to listen to what I say. Among your friends, Job, and most assume because he's the first to speak that Eliphaz had the place of honor, that he's the oldest of the three friends. He's saying, come on, Job, there's gray hair here. Older than your father. Eliphaz is pulling rank. Now, brothers and sisters, I want to be clear this morning that the Bible puts a particular honor on age and on experience in the life of faith. The Bible recognizes that as a general principle. We are to have a certain honor and a certain respect for those who are aged in faith and in grace. We need to remember that. The Apostle Paul tells Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 5 that he needs to be careful to speak respectfully and graciously to those who are older than him. The fifth commandment, honor your father and your mother, reminds us that honor is due in part to people who are aged in grace and in faith, because those are things that are supposed to mature with years. Those are things that are supposed to mature with experience. But age and experience, we need to remember, do not always express themselves in wisdom. And age and experience do not always translate into the truth. Wisdom teaches us in Ecclesiastes 4, verse 13, better was a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who no longer knew how to take advice. Better is a young and wise man than a foolish king who has forgotten what it is to take advice. And this morning, as a young preacher, if I can dare to say, there is a particular temptation to the aging and the aged, to forget what it is to take advice, to hold age up as a badge of honor, and to think because I'm advanced in age, all that I say is true. And you see, that's what Eliphaz is doing here. He's saying, Job, I'm old, so I'm right. You're young, so you've got to be wrong. But it's a reminder to us this morning that no Christian, no matter their age, ought to rest on a badge of honor. that growth in age and experience does not mean, brothers and sisters, that any of us will ever grow to the point where we are never wrong. And you see, Eliphaz has this overestimation of himself. He overvalues himself. I'm old, Job, so I'm right. You're young, so you are wrong. And because of that, he thinks he has the freedom to hurl these accusations at Job. And it's not only that Eliphaz misunderstands and overestimates himself, but to put it this way, these accusations also come as a result of Eliphaz really being unyielding. And what I mean by that this morning is they come because Eliphaz is a stubborn man. He's stubborn. In verse 17, he says, I will show you, hear me, and what I have seen, I will declare. And what he goes on to say for the rest of the chapter, as I've already, it's a doubling down of what he's already said. It's a recommitment to his wrong views. He doubles down. He says, Job, you need to be silent. You need to listen to my experience. You need to listen to the way that I understand the world. And when you read those verses, you actually find Eliphaz is horribly exaggerating his case. He's trying to show Job, look, only the wicked suffer. Only the unrighteous suffer. And to do that, he begins to exaggerate all kinds of things. The wicked man writhes in pain all his days. Well, no, he doesn't. All of us have seen the wicked prosper. An elementary school kid could tell Eliphaz he's wrong. Eliphaz in verse 24 says, distress and anguish terrify him. They prevail against him like a king ready for... No, they don't. The unrighteous in this world often go on in peace and comfort. Eliphaz goes as far to say that in this life, the wicked will always receive repayment. In verse 31, let him not trust in emptiness, deceiving himself, for emptiness will be his payment. It will be paid in full before his time. And Christianity reminds us that's not true. That God in the end and in all eternity will set right what is wrong, but often the wicked in this life seem unaddressed by justice. Eliphaz exaggerates his case. And he has an unyielding stubbornness. He refuses to see things differently. Remember a number of years ago, I was talking to a young woman. And she was living in some lifestyles that she shouldn't have been living in. And I said, you know, you really can't do that. And she said, you know, the harder you push against me, the more I'm going to dig my heels in. I'm a really stubborn person. I said, is that a virtue? Is it a virtue to be stubborn, especially in ungodly things? And I was met with silence. And you see, that's what Eliphaz does. He is stubborn and he will not yield to the facts. He will not yield to truth. He will not yield to wisdom. Eliphaz is so stubborn, he will not even yield to God himself. And so he launches his accusations at Job. See, here's the cumulative picture of Eliphaz. Here's a cumulative picture of this friend. Here's a man with gray hair, wearing that crown of the aged that we read in the scriptures. Here's a gray-haired man that is likely well-read in his day, who has a good bit of knowledge, who has some understanding of the way in which the world works, who is a man that people go to for counsel and for wisdom. Here is that man. But on the other hand, he's stubborn. And he overestimates himself. And he misunderstands things as they truly are. And when you begin to get that cumulative picture, it seems it's probably a little uncomfortable. Because all of us this morning, could say, oh, I know Eliphaz. I know people just like him. The world is full of Eliphazes. The world is full of people just like this. But you see, brothers and sisters, these words are not here so that we can discover all the Eliphazes around us. They're here so we can understand and be cautioned against the Eliphaz in our own hearts, against that part of us that misunderstands things, against that part of us that overestimates and overvalues ourselves, against that part of us that is so stubborn we would, if push came to shove, defy God himself. And it cautions us. It warns us the dangers of being such an accuser. But secondly and briefly this morning, let's look at Job's answer. Let's look at Job's answer. Here, in a very real sense, we have something in chapter 15 that is common. It's common. All of us, as I said when we began, all of us have been falsely accused. Job's false accusations come in the context of suffering. Our false accusations that are made against us come in all kinds of shapes, in all kinds of forms, and in all kinds of times. And the question is, how do we respond? Because if you've been falsely accused, you know how hopeless the situation can seem. You know how paralyzing it is to be falsely accused, how it seems to have a strangled grip on you, and it seems there's no resolution, there's no answer here. Here, these accusations are being hurled against me. People have misunderstood me. People arrogantly proclaim things of which they do not know, and people are stubborn. All of us know what it's like. And the question is, how do we respond? How ought we to respond when accusations like this, whether it's in our suffering or whether it's in some other context, what do we do when people hurl their accusations at us? When they break us with their war clubs, when they stab us with their swords, when they seek to pierce us with the sharp arrow of false accusations? Well, what I want you to see is how Job answers Eliphaz. In the very first verses of chapter 16, he dismisses Eliphaz's words. Eliphaz, your words are useless to me. Your words cause no help. They actually add to my suffering. They're empty. They go on and on. Will you ever close your mouth? That's Job's attitude. But then what we see in chapter 16 and in chapter 17 is what we might call this threefold answer to Eliphaz's accusations. And the first answer that Job gives is that Job answers with his innocence. He uses his innocence, we might say, to shield him and to protect him against the accusations of Eliphaz. In chapter 16, after Job dismisses his words, in verse 6, Job begins to describe once again his sufferings. He goes into great detail about what it is that he is suffering. And I wish we had more time to open that up, because Job uses terms that are very similar to the Psalms. And in particular, he uses terms and expressions that are used in the Psalms, which are then in the New Testament applied to Jesus. Job uses language and imagery similar to Psalm 22, similar to Psalm 69, similar to Psalm 102, all of which Jesus takes on his lips. But you see, Job opens up these sufferings, all these things that he endures. And then look at chapter 16, verse 16. My face is red with weeping, and on my eyelids is deep darkness. In verse 17, although there is no violence in my hands, and my prayer is pure. Do you hear what Job is saying? All this suffering is true of me. But here is something else that is true. There's no violence in my hands, and my prayer is pure. What is Job saying? Job is saying, I am innocent. I am suffering as one who is innocent of these things you accuse. You come at me with your accusations. You come at me with your charges. You come at me with your indictments. But I am innocent. I am innocent towards men. There's no violence in my hands. And I'm innocent toward God. My prayer is pure. And what Job is doing in this moment is he is saying, my innocence proves the case. And I want you to know when Job says that, he's being sincere. There are some people who will throw that around without thought and without purpose. Oh, I'm innocent. I haven't done anything. Job is saying this as one who has searched his heart. Job is saying this as one who has pled with these friends, show me true sin in my life. Job is saying this as one who has yielded himself to God and actually said in previous chapters, God, show me my sin. And there is no sin to be found for which Job is in particular suffering for. And so Job uses his innocence as a great defense. And as a reminder to us that false accusations are the source of terrible suffering. It hurts to be falsely accused. But what a blessing it is to have a clear conscience. I remember when I was in high school, my youth pastor, the very first verse when he came as our youth pastor, the very first verse he had all of us memorize was Proverbs 10:9. A man of integrity walks securely, but he who takes crooked paths will be found out. A man of integrity walks securely. And in fact, if you remember the Apostle Paul in Ephesians chapter 6, as he's writing in jail and he's warning the Ephesians and he's warning us in that letter to stand fast in the day of evil, to not yield to Satan, our great enemy. What does he say? He tells us to put on the whole armor of God. And what is part of that armor? It's the breastplate of righteousness. And we see the way in which, again and again, we have the freedom when we have searched our hearts before God and we can say, I have not sinned in this matter, how that itself is armor to us. The psalmist often puts on that breastplate. Often does the psalm go to the Lord and say, they accuse me wrongly. My enemies come against me for no purpose and for no reason. My hands are clean. And that's what Job is saying. And it's a reminder to us that honesty before men and honesty before God and living a life of integrity and living a life of sincerity and living a life of a clean conscience, who can gainsay it? Who can bring a valid accusation against one who honors men and honors God, who loves men and loves God as we have been commanded? Job's first answer is to say, I'm innocent. His second answer is assistance. Look at verse 19 of chapter 16. Even now, behold, my witness is in heaven, and he who testifies for me is on high. So Job has just said, I'm innocent of these charges, but Job doesn't rest there. Job goes where? Job goes to heaven. Job ascends to the highest of heights, and he says, even now, behold, my witness is in heaven, and he who testifies for me is on high. That word testify quite literally means advocate. It's the picture of a lawyer. Job is saying, I've got a lawyer in heaven. I've got a lawyer in heaven who is witnessing for me, who is my advocate. I've got one. What does the word advocate mean? It means one who vouches for me. You remember what Job cried in Job chapter 9, verse 33? Oh, that there was an arbiter. Oh, that there was an arbiter between God and between me. One who could lay his hand upon God. One who could lay his hand upon me. Oh, that there was an arbiter. And now in this 19th verse, Job ascends on the heights of faith to say, there is an advocate. I have a heavenly witness. I don't by myself testify to my innocence in this, but I have one who is on high, who is my lawyer, who himself will vouch for me. That's what Job is saying. And here it is the object of Job's faith. And this advocate is the object of all of Job's hopes. His friends falsely accuse me. And Job says, wait a second. I've got a witness. I've got an advocate. I've got one who will speak on my behalf. I have one who himself, in verse 21, will argue the case of a man with God himself. That's what Job is saying. And where is Job's faith going? What is Job speaking of there? Well, it's so plain to us who now have the New Testament. But Job's faith is going to the Son of God. Job's faith is going to the Son of God who in time became flesh and who is, as the Apostle Paul says in 1 Timothy 2, there is one mediator between God and man, the man Jesus Christ. Job's faith is going to the one who will take flesh, the one who himself will become man, whom the Apostle John says, if we sin, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ, the righteous. And Job is looking there by faith. Job is seeing that by faith. And in a very real sense, what Job is saying is he is saying, Eliphaz, take your accusations to Jesus. Because he's my defense. He's my advocate. You can charge me with whatever you want. But Christ stands as my sure defense. You see, brothers and sisters, sometimes that's the best defense against false accusations, to entrust ourselves to God. Peter tells us in 1 Peter chapter 2 that when Jesus was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he was accused, he didn't accuse in return. But Peter says he entrusted himself to God who will judge justly. And what Job is doing, what Job is doing is clinging to that promise that we have presented in Romans 8. The height of our Christian assurance. What does Paul say? In Romans 8, he says, who shall bring a charge against God's elect? It is Christ who has died. It is Christ who is risen again. It is Christ who justifies, who covers the unrighteous with his righteousness. Who, as the Apostle Paul says in 2 Corinthians 5, who became sin for us that we might become the righteousness of God in him. And Job is clinging to that gospel promise as the arrows and the sword and the club of false accusations come against him. Take your accusations to Jesus. Because my life is hid with him. And my righteousness is found in him. Job pleads, he answers with assistance from heaven. And third, very briefly, he answers with perseverance. He answers with perseverance. In chapter 17, Job gives us more notes of his suffering. And then he adds this, after verses 1 through 7, where he talks about his suffering, in verse 8, the upright are appalled at this, and the innocent stirs himself up against the godless. In verse 9, hear these words, yet the righteous holds to his way, and he who has clean hands grows stronger and stronger. But you come on again, all of you, and I shall not find a wise man among you. What Job is saying there, just very briefly, is simply this. Despite my suffering, despite the false accusations that you bring against me, Job is saying, I'm going to hold to my way. I'm going to hold to my way. The righteous, in verse 9, holds to his way. What's our immediate response when we often get falsely accused? I'll tell you what my immediate response is. Whether it's in my heart or whether I actually speak it, it says, I'm going to get even. No matter the cost, no matter what it costs me, I'm going to get even with the person who is falsely accusing me. And how many people, brothers and sisters, have crashed their ship on that rock? I'm going to get even. I'm going to get revenge. Tit for tat. Time to fight fire with fire. If they're going to say that, then just listen to what I'm going to say. Listen to what I'm going to do. See and watch, no matter the cost. And sometimes we act like when we're wronged, that it's okay to wrong somebody in return. Sometimes we act that when we suffer, there's a little parenthetical note in God's law that says, well, you shouldn't do this or that unless somebody does it to you first. As if our suffering gives us an excuse to sin. But what Job is saying is no. No matter how many accusations you bring against me, no matter how you speak against me, you foolish friends, I'm holding to the way. I'm holding to the way of righteousness. I will not break my integrity to respond to your false accusations. Job perseveres in what is right. You see, brothers and sisters, Job's friend seems here to have turned a foe. And he comes with accusations that if you and I actually had to face them, if a friend was sitting before us saying these things, it would likely break us into 1,000 pieces. But how does Job answer? Job answers by claiming his innocence, by pleading for assistance from the Son of God, the only mediator, our advocate before the Father, and by committing himself in the strength of the Spirit to persevere through the accusations. That's how Job responds. But even as we see Job in this text this morning, brothers and sisters, we need to see through Job and see Jesus. See another who actually was falsely accused in the fullest sense, in whom there was no sin and no guile, whose hands offered no violence and whose prayers were always pure, without a spot or a stain of sin. And yet what reproach he endured for our sake. What accusations were hurled against the one who is the Son of God in order that you and I might be saved. We see through Job to the picture of the one who would come, who truly is the righteous sufferer. And in him is all the hope of the gospel. Let's pray.